Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.17, The Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, The Macedonian Struggle, Part 2. This episode is brought to you by Patreon subscriber Colin B. Thank you so much for your monthly pledge. I appreciate you, and your support really helps to keep this show going. So shout out and big thank you to Colin. All right, so last time we introduced the Macedonian struggle, in which basically every single one of the new nation states of the Balkans laid some sort of claim on Macedonia. And whether it be the Greeks and their Megali idea, which sought to resurrect the Byzantine Empire, or the Serbs wanting to reconstruct the medieval Serbian kingdom, or the Bulgarians hoping to recreate the big Bulgaria of San Stefano, each and every one of these new nation-states made use of nationalistic narratives to assert their historic right to claim Macedonia. And then while these Christian nation-states were pressing their expansionist agendas hard in Macedonia, the Ottomans were doing everything they could to maintain order in the region and to halt these expansionist projects of Greece, Serbia, and Bulgaria. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, these competing claims to Macedonia would create a ton of instability in the region, as guerrilla bands freely roamed throughout the countryside. These guerrillas would attack Ottoman military garrisons, skirmish with each other, assassinate public officials, carry out death sentences on rival leaders, sabotage public infrastructure, and just raid and plunder local villages for provisions. These guerrillas would also occasionally team up with church leaders and with representatives from their respective nation states, all in an effort to win the hearts and minds of the Macedonian peasants. And then, as we talked about, even though the Macedonian struggle would be defined by interethnic violence, the efforts of these guerrillas to win the people over to their cause were not always violent, as Bulgarian, Serbian, and Greek representatives would also offer towns and villages certain services that the villagers were very often in desperate need of. For example, they might protect villages from the Bashibazouks or from other bandit gangs. They might build churches and schools, or they might provide the town with a teacher and a priest. And within the generally lawless atmosphere of late Ottoman Macedonia, these essential services were often welcomed by the Macedonian peasants, and many guerrilla leaders would become pretty popular amongst everyday Macedonians, who would come to see these revolutionaries as their protectors. Now, we ended the last episode by covering the Cretan Revolt of 1896, which had brought the Ottomans and the Greeks to declare war on each other in 1897. As we saw, the Greco-Turkish War was a very quick conflict in which the Ottomans absolutely spanked the Greeks. This Ottoman victory would briefly elevate Sultan Abdulhamid's status in the empire, and the Greek defeat would create a national humiliation in Greece as the Greek army proved itself to be wholly unprepared for a real-life military conflict. And then in classic fashion, the final terms after the Greco-Turkish War were settled by the Great Powers, and as usual, this Great Power settlement would end up making everyone involved equally angry and resentful. Because even though Crete was granted autonomy, which had been the primary goal of hyper-nationalist Greek officers in the secret society, the Ethnikia Tyria, Greece was saddled with a crippling amount of debt after the war, and the Greek government in Athens was forced to hand over their finances to a commission of European diplomats. So, yep, the Greeks now get to join the Egyptians, Tunisians, Bulgarians, and Ottomans, as they too will now have to deal with European financial experts who will make the Greeks increasingly beholden to Western financiers. And then for the Ottomans, they had been forced to give up their control of the island of Crete, even though they had easily won the war against the Greeks. So, resentment amongst Ottoman military officers towards the meddling of the Great Powers would continue to grow after the Ottoman army was robbed of any reward following this hard-earned victory. The humiliation faced by Greek leaders in Athens and the increasing resentment felt by Ottoman officers would have lasting effects that would ripple out into Macedonia and would help to drive events towards 1908. To begin with, more and more Ottoman Muslim officers would become radicalized in the years following the Greco-Turkish War, as many began to see Abdulhamid as too soft when dealing with the great powers. The vast majority of these disaffected officers would be members of the Third Army of Macedonia. Additionally, throughout the 1890s, the Ethniki Etairia had pressured the Greek government to put a ton of resources into the effort to annex Crete into Greece. And this diversion of resources would significantly weaken the position of the Greek state and the Greek church within Macedonia. Meaning that, moving into the 20th century, Bulgarian and Slavic Macedonian guerrilla bands and church officials would increasingly grow their influence in Macedonia, as the weakened position of the Greek Patriarchate and the Greek state would leave a power vacuum in the region. And the group who will be most responsible for this growing influence of Slavic guerrilla bands in Macedonia is the subject of today's episode. The Macedonian Revolutionary Organization. The origins of the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, or the MRO for short, go back to the early 1890s when the society was first founded by Macedo-Bulgarian teachers living in Salonika. The bustling Aegean port city of Salonika, which today is in Greece and known as Thessaloniki, had long been the commercial and administrative capital of Ottoman Macedonia, and Salonika was by far the region's most populous city. Eventually, Salonika will emerge as the nucleus of the 1908 revolution, and it will serve as the operational headquarters for the CUP as they solidify their rule following the revolution. So we will be talking a lot more about Salonika in the coming episodes. But for now, we just need to know that at this time, Salonika was one of the most diverse cities in the entire world. And in Salonika, there had long existed a cosmopolitan culture in which Turks, Albanians, Greeks, Bulgarians, Serbs, Roma, Vlachs, Macedo-Slavs, and the Donme all lived and prospered together within a thriving melting pot. And then the group that really most defined Salonika and made up the majority of the city's population were the Sephardic Jews, a Jewish community originally from Spain and Portugal who had found refuge in the relatively more hospitable Ottoman Empire after they were violently driven from the Iberian Peninsula following the Spanish Inquisition. So, Salonika was a very diverse city, home to many different ethnic groups. But the one group who had long been on the bottom of the hierarchy in Salonika were the Slavs, or Macedo-Bulgarians, as they are often called. Most Macedo-Bulgarians had at some point immigrated to Salonika from the surrounding countryside, where the vast majority of peasants were Orthodox Slavs, who professed loyalty to either the Greek Patriarchate or the Bulgarian Exarchate. So, Salonika was a bustling and diverse urban center, surrounded by a rural countryside populated primarily by Slavic-speaking Christian peasants. And as the Bulgarian, Greek, and Serbian governments tried to win over this Slavic Macedonian peasant population, these new nations would put a lot of resources towards establishing schools in Macedonian towns and cities, like Salonika. So many Slavic peasants would begin to move to the city to receive a good education at one of these Greek or Bulgarian schools. And at these schools, the students would often become indoctrinated into the nationalist movements of each respective nation, which really was the real reason why Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia put so many resources towards establishing these types of schools. It was a humanitarian gesture to help improve the lives of the impoverished Macedonian Christians, yes, but it was also meant to extend the influence of each of these rival nations and to prepare Macedonia to be annexed into Greece, Bulgaria, or Serbia, because it was assumed by just about everyone that it was only a matter of time until the Ottomans lost control of Macedonia. Now, Greek schools had actually been present in the region for many, many years. So really, the biggest change in the 1880s and 1890s was the proliferation of Bulgarian schools representing the interests of both the new Bulgarian principality and the Church of the Bulgarian Exarchate. These Bulgarian schools would begin to churn out a new generation of highly educated young people who were exposed both to Western liberal ideas and to Bulgarian nationalism. But the problem was that in cities like Salonika, these highly educated young people were often left without any job prospects because, as we have just said, Salonika had long been dominated by non-Slavic groups like the Sephardic Jews. And as we all know, having a bunch of highly educated, highly ambitious, and unemployed young people roaming the streets is a dangerous situation. And indeed, many, many of these newly educated Macedo-Bulgarians would turn to teaching as a profession, and then they would also begin to turn towards radical politics as an outlet for their ambitions. On November 1st, 1893, a young Macedo-Bulgarian student by the name of Dom Gruev was walking the streets of Salonika with a friend when the two students happened upon one of their teachers. These three men then began to argue about the future of Macedonia, specifically discussing how to combat the increase of Serbian and Greek propaganda, and how they might be able to drive the Ottomans out of Macedonia. That night, they would resolve to form a revolutionary committee, and though they did not know it at the time, Dom Gruev and his compatriots had just founded one of the most influential revolutionary organizations in all of Balkan history. Because even though the group would have many different names over the coming years, the founding of this three-man committee in 1893 in Salonika represented the beginning of the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization. After this initial meeting, the MRO would begin to secretly recruit members amongst that emerging population of highly educated and very unemployed Macedo-Bulgarians. And during this early period, the MRO would recruit a young man who had recently returned to Macedonia after dropping out of the Bulgarian Military Academy. And this young man was none other than Goca Delchev. Even though the original founder, Dom Gruev, would continue to be important within the MRO, it would really be Goca Delchev who would drive the future course of the secret organization, as Delchev would be most responsible for rapidly growing the MRO's ranks, and he would come to define the organization's governing ideology. Goca Delchev grew up in a central Macedonian town called Kilkis, that is today in northern Greece, but was then a part of Ottoman Macedonia. In the late 19th century, Kilkis, like many of the other rural towns of Macedonia, was populated mostly by Slavs, and the town came under the control of the Bulgarian Exarchate in 1884. So, from a young age, Delchev was immersed in the culture of the Bulgarian National Revival. And when he was a boy, Delchev became enamored by revolutionary figures of the Bulgarian liberation struggle, such as Vasil Levski and Hristo Botev. When Delchev was 16, he was sent off to the Bulgarian Men's High School of Salonika, which was the same high school that MRO founder Dom Gruev had also attended as a young man. And over the coming years, the Bulgarian Men's High School of Salonika would act as a major revolutionary incubator, as dozens of revolutionaries would all graduate from this one single school in Salonika. And many of them would then get jobs at the high school as teachers, which explains why the school would continuously churn out Macedonian revolutionaries. One of Goca Delchev's fellow classmates at the Bulgarian Men's High School was a young man named Boris Sarafov, who will emerge as yet another very important figure within Macedonian radical politics. And even though Sarafov and Delchev would eventually become revolutionary rivals, as young students, Sarafov and Delchev were friends and comrades. And both young men would join a secret revolutionary brotherhood at their high school. And they would also both choose to attend the Military Academy of Bulgaria upon graduating, which had been established in Sofia shortly after Bulgaria had gained its autonomy in 1878. When they arrived in the Bulgarian capital, Delchev and Sarafov would join a much larger community of Macedonian immigrants and refugees who lived and studied in Sofia. And over the coming years, more and more Macedonians would continue to pour into Sofia. And many of these Macedonian immigrants were, like Delchev and Sarafov, highly educated. And because the new Bulgarian principality was in dire need of competent people to fill out their brand new military and bureaucracy, the Bulgarian government in Sofia would in many ways come to be dominated by these highly educated Macedonians, who would push the Bulgarian government to adopt a more and more aggressive policy towards the Macedonian question. During their time at the military academy in Sofia, Gota Delchev and Boris Sarafov would begin to pursue somewhat divergent paths that would come to define each of their future revolutionary careers. Gota Delchev, for his part, quickly grew tired and disillusioned with his life as a military cadet, and he would begin to seek out other outlets for his idealistic ambitions. This dissatisfaction with military life would lead Delchev to begin working with Macedonian literary groups, and he would also begin to dip his toes into the world of radical left-wing politics within Bulgaria, as he became friends with the leader of the Bulgarian Social Democratic Workers' Party. Through this connection, and through his work with the Macedonian literary societies, Delchev would become immersed within the radical scene of Sofia, and from this point on, Delchev would begin to develop a unique vision for the future of Macedonia, influenced by the left-wing ideologies swirling at this time, including anarchism and international socialism. So, it would be while operating within this world of radical Bulgarian politics that Gota Delchev would first begin to hear that a few Macedo-Bulgarians in Salonika were starting up a new revolutionary organization, whose primary goal was to achieve Macedonian autonomy. And then, after Delchev's activities amongst Bulgarian leftists came to the attention of the leadership at the Bulgarian military school, Delchev would be expelled in the fall of 1894, just a month before he was supposed to graduate. So, Delchev would take this opportunity to leave military life behind him, and he would travel back across the border into Ottoman Macedonia and join up with Dom Gruev. And from this point on, Gota Delchev would become the beating heart of the MRO. With the arrival of Gota Delchev into the MRO, the organization would begin to model themselves off of Vasilevsky's internal revolutionary organization. Vasilevsky had long been Gota Delchev's hero, and Delchev had become a vocal advocate for Levsky's approach to the liberation struggle. Now, you may or may not remember from episode 1.13 that Vasilevsky had spent many years within Ottoman Bulgaria, establishing local revolutionary committees and working directly with Bulgarian peasants to educate them and to open their eyes to the potential benefits of waging a revolutionary struggle for their liberation. And even though he was hanged by the Ottoman authorities before this liberation was achieved, the efforts of Levski had ultimately laid the groundwork for the 1876 April uprising that had eventually gained Bulgaria its autonomy. But what many would forget in later generations is that Vasilevsky had actually urged caution against launching an uprising prematurely, as Levski always argued that it was essential for the Bulgarian people to achieve their liberation on their own behalf, without the intervention of a great power. But, of course, after Levski's death, the April uprising had ultimately been launched prematurely. And the only reason that the uprising would ultimately lead to Bulgarian autonomy was because Ottoman repression after the uprising failed had been so severe that it gave the Russians an excuse to invade the Ottoman Empire. So, ultimately, Bulgarian liberation had been achieved through great power intervention, an outcome that Levski had specifically warned against. And seeing as Russia would then go on to treat Bulgaria as a pseudo-colony for years, you can kind of understand why Levski was always so insistent that the Bulgarians needed to liberate themselves without outside assistance. As we will see, Gota Delchev will follow in Levski's footsteps, and he will similarly argue that the people of Macedonia needed to liberate themselves without the military intervention of an outside power. And with this overall goal in mind, Delchev would push the MRO to focus their initial efforts on education and on network building. Delchev always warned MRO members against hasty action that might bring on the wrath of the Ottoman authorities before the Macedonian people were ready to defend themselves. So, through Delchev's leadership, the MRO would begin the hard work of building a revolutionary network within Macedonia and eventually within Thrace as well. This work would include setting up local committees, educating peasants, and radicalizing them into the revolutionary struggle, and gathering weapons to be distributed to these different committees. And one way that I've heard this process described is that Delchev and the MRO were essentially working to build a state within a state, the idea being that you could construct the skeleton of a revolutionary government through a network of committees. Then liberation would be as easy as simply shedding the old Ottoman skin once conditions were ripe for a mass uprising. So, through the leadership of Gotze Delchev, the MRO would take Levski's motto, freedom or death, and they would also take Levski's organizational framework as they built a decentralized network of revolutionary committees all throughout Macedonia and Thrace. And Delchev would always fill a role very similar to Levski as he traveled around from town to town building connections and winning people over to the cause with his charismatic leadership and inspirational speaking style. Delchev really was kind of the second coming of the great revolutionary apostle. From its inception, the MRO held goals that at times seem quite contradictory. And these contradictory aims are the reason why the modern nation-states of both Bulgaria and North Macedonia claim the MRO as their revolutionary ancestors and revere Gotze Delchev as a national hero. Dom Gruev, the MRO's founder, would state that the primary goal of the MRO was always to win autonomy for the region of Macedonia. Then one of the organization's mottos was Macedonia for the Macedonians. And as we have said, Macedonia was an insanely diverse place. So this motto was self-consciously inclusive and represented a multi-ethnic and multi-religious vision for the future of Macedonia. But at the same time, nearly all of the members of the MRO were Macedo-Bulgarians, and Gruev himself would openly admit that Macedonian autonomy was seen as simply the best way in which to eventually unify with Bulgaria. And the context we need to have in mind here is that Eastern Rumelia had also begun as an autonomous Ottoman region, and this autonomy had allowed Eastern Rumelia to easily unite with Bulgaria in 1885. So, from the beginning, autonomy for Macedonia was both a goal to be pursued for its own sake, and it was seen by many members as the most effective way to eventually unite with Bulgaria. But with all that said, the thing we need to understand most about the MRO is that, more than anything else, the MRO was a highly decentralized revolutionary organization, meaning that over the many decades in which it would operate in Macedonia, the organization's goals and ideology would transform as new members joined and old members, well, died. Macedonia was a dangerous place, and MRO leaders were constantly getting arrested or being assassinated or getting killed while taking part in guerrilla actions. So, trying to pin down a single unifying ideology for the MRO is a difficult task, and many leaders would rise to power and claim that they led the MRO as a whole, but in reality, they often had little practical control over the many different revolutionary committees scattered throughout Macedonia and Thrace. But if there was one consistent aim of the MRO throughout the 1890s and early 1900s, it was to achieve autonomy for Macedonia and Thrace. Even though Macedonian autonomy would remain the overriding goal of the MRO, in the two decades following the organization's founding, there would be a discernible shift in the MRO's relationship with Free Bulgaria, which was what most Macedo-Bulgarians called the autonomous principality of Bulgaria. Essentially, a lot of leaders of the MRO would begin to move away from the idea of eliciting the help of Free Bulgaria in their liberation struggle, because people like Gotse Delchev would argue that a Bulgarian invasion into Ottoman Macedonia would be disastrous for both Bulgaria and the people of Macedonia. Delchev pointed to the recent example of the Greco-Turkish War, in which the newly modernized Ottoman army had stomped all over the Greek army, and he would argue that the same thing was likely to happen should a war break out between the Bulgarians and the Ottomans over Macedonia. And then, on top of this, if recent history was any indicator, a conflict like this would be catastrophic for the people of Macedonia, as such a war would undoubtedly unleash the wrath of the Bashibazouks on the Christian peasants of Macedonia. But even with these warnings coming from the MRO leaders operating inside of Macedonia, revolutionaries operating across the border in Free Bulgaria would still begin to aggressively push the Bulgarian military to intervene in Macedonia. This effort to prompt a war of liberation between Free Bulgaria and the Ottomans would be led by a revolutionary committee known as the Supreme Macedonian Committee, or the Supremacists, as they are often called. The Supremacist was a revolutionary society based in the Bulgarian capital of Sofia, and their organization was made up almost entirely of Bulgarian military officers. So, the Supremacists were kind of like the Bulgarian version of the Greek Ethnikia Tyria, that expansionist society of hyper-nationalist officers that had entangled the Greek government in the Cretan Revolt. Like the Ethnikia Tyria, the Supremacists spent most of their time trying to entangle Bulgaria in a war with the Ottomans. The idea here was that such a war would ignite the fighting spirit of everyday Macedonian peasants. But even more importantly, the war was meant to prompt an intervention from the Russians. And with Russian support, conditions would be favorable for the Bulgarian principality to annex Macedonia. So, while the MRO inside of Macedonia was preaching patience as they worked to build a robust network of revolutionary committees, the supremacists inside of Free Bulgaria were itching for action and always planning the next revolt. In 1895, shortly after the organization was founded, the supremacists would begin forming Cheta guerrilla bands, and they would lead these bands across the border into Ottoman Macedonia. This guerrilla band would eventually number some 800 irregular fighters and would be led by a few dozen officers from the Bulgarian army, including Gotse Delchev's old classmate, Boris Sarafov. So let's check in with Sarafov. So, after Gotse Delchev had been expelled from the military academy and returned to Macedonia, Boris Sarafov had elected to remain in Sofia, where he would complete his education and become a Bulgarian army officer in 1894. Then, a year later, Sarafov would join up with the supremacists, and he would take an active part in this 1895 Cheta action into Macedonia. On the whole, this lightning attack into Ottoman Macedonia was a complete and utter disaster. The operation was meant to bring the attention of the great powers to the Macedonian issue, the hope being that the great powers would pressure the Ottoman Empire to enact reforms or to grant autonomy to Macedonia. But instead, the great powers became very angry that a bunch of Bulgarian army officers were disturbing the status quo in the Balkans, and they chastised the Bulgarian government in Sofia for allowing this to happen. Then, as the MRO had predicted, the attack brought on fierce reprisals from the Ottoman government as Bashibazouks attacked the Bulgarian villages where the uprisings had taken place. And then, of course, the supremacists who had actually led this attack all fled back across the Bulgarian border, meaning that while Macedonian civilians were suffering terrible atrocities at the hands of the Bashibazouks, the Bulgarian officers amongst these supremacists were back home safe in Sofia. In the years following this disastrous attack, The influence of the Bulgarian officers in the supremacists would briefly be eclipsed by the influence of the MRO agents operating inside of Macedonia, as the MRO's more gradual strategy of education and network building was proven to be the better option. Now, we will be coming back to these hyper-nationalist officers in the supremacists, because in 1901, their organization would be taken over by a powerful Bulgarian general. And this Bulgarian general will use his connections within the Bulgarian military to re-empower the supremacists, and he will once more put all of the organization's efforts towards launching yet another Cheta invasion into Ottoman Macedonia, specifically in order to prompt a war between the Bulgarian principality and the Ottoman Empire. And even though this second invasion would be much larger than the earlier attempt in 1895, this supremacist invasion would still prove to be premature, and in the short term, it would have similarly disastrous results for both the Bulgarian government and for the people of Macedonia. But with that said, this second Cheta action from the supremacists in 1902 will end up knocking down the first domino of a cascading sequence of events that will eventually force the hand of the MRO and lead the internal organization to launch their long-awaited uprising in 1903, years before the MRO felt fully prepared for such an uprising. Now, the Ilinden Uprising of 1903 will end up being absolutely massive, and it is also the primary focus of next week's episode. So we will be coming back to these Bulgarian officers in the supremacists currently laying plans for a premature Cheta invasion. And we will also be talking all about how this invasion will ultimately create the conditions for the Ilinden Uprising. But for the rest of today's episode, we are going to keep our attention on the MRO operating inside of Macedonia. And specifically, we will now introduce an MRO leader who will go on to be a pretty important figure within our overall narrative, as this MRO leader will eventually throw his support behind the Young Turks and join the Ottoman parliament after 1908. So let's introduce Jan Sandanski. Jan Sandanski was born in a small mountain village on the Macedonian-Bulgarian border. When Sandanski was 6 years old, the 1878 Treaty of Berlin had separated Macedonia from Free Bulgaria. And after his family found themselves on the Ottoman side of the border, Sandanski's father would join the Krasnoyarsk Uprising, which tried but failed to elicit great power support for the unification of Macedonia with the new Bulgarian principality. And then, like so many other Macedo-Bulgarians, the Sandanski family fled across the border into Bulgaria in order to escape the ruthless retribution of the Bashibazouks following the 1878 revolt. Unlike some of his other future comrades, Sandanski grew up quite poor, and he was forced to drop out of school in order to work as a shoemaker's apprentice. But then in 1892, the 20-year-old Sandanski would be drafted into the Bulgarian army. And after serving for a few years, Sandanski would briefly join up with the supremacists, taking part in a few different Cheta guerrilla actions, including the disastrous 1895 raid. And as we just noted, these supremacist attacks led absolutely nothing to actually change in Macedonia and only brought about immense suffering for the Macedonian peasantry. But for Sandanski personally, he did at least get a nasty injury during one of these raids, and this would force him to leave military service behind, and he would then turn his efforts towards political activism. Now disillusioned with the ineffectiveness of the supremacist strategy of pointless guerrilla raids, Sandanski would make contact with the MRO. And in 1901, Sandanski began working with Gotadelchev to organize revolutionary committees within Ottoman Macedonia. Like many Macedonian revolutionaries, Sandanski was drawn to Gotadelchev's more long-term vision for the liberation of Macedonia, which focused on education and network building, and which placed emphasis on the need for the Macedonians to liberate themselves without the intervention of an outside power. Because Sandanski was an experienced fighter and political organizer, he would quickly rise within the ranks of the MRO, and he would prove himself to be quite effective at establishing revolutionary committees throughout Macedonia and Thrace. And over the next couple years, Sandanski would become one of Gotsedelchev's closest confidants and one of his most trusted advisors. But the event that would really launch Sandanski's career and bring him to fame, not only within Macedonia, but throughout the entire world, would be his involvement in the Miss Stone Affair. So let's talk about the Miss Stone Affair, America's very first hostage crisis. Ever since it was first founded in the early 1890s, the MRO had always been short on money. And moving into the 20th century, they had essentially become completely broke. So, Gotsedelchev and other MRO leaders had opened up a fierce debate over the best way to raise money for the organization. And as we have said, through Delchev's leadership, the MRO had adopted more of a populist ideology, and the organization had begun to see itself as the protectors of the Macedonian peasantry. But the problem with this more populist approach was that, historically, one of the primary ways that the MRO raised money was through the euphemistically named revolutionary tax, which was essentially just MRO agents demanding donations from villagers at gunpoint. And well, Gotsedelchev argued, quite reasonably, that this was having the effect of making the MRO a wee bit unpopular with Macedonian peasants, whom they were allegedly fighting to liberate. So, Gotsedelchev would argue that the organization needed to move away from extorting lots of poor people, and they should instead extort just a few really rich people. And well, this was sound logic, so the MRO began making plans to kidnap and ransom some very high-profile people. While these debates were ongoing, Jan Sandanski, as an eager new member, would step up to the plate and offer to lead this fundraising operation. And Sandanski actually threw out the idea of kidnapping the Prince of Bulgaria himself, Prince Ferdinand. But Delchev thought that this would create division amongst Bulgarians, something that was always very distressing for Delchev. And so, after a few more harebrained schemes, they finally landed on kidnapping an American Protestant missionary. And so began what would go down in history as the Miss Stone Affair. Ellen Stone was a Protestant missionary and suffragette from Boston, Massachusetts, who by 1900 had been teaching Bulgarian schoolchildren for 20 years. In her education work, Miss Stone worked with local Bulgarian women, and one such acquaintance was a young Bulgarian Protestant named Katerina Silka. Silka was originally from northern Macedonia, but she had lived in the United States for several years while attending seminary and nursing school in New England. And after returning home, Silka began working with Ellen Stone in her hometown in Macedonia. Then, in September of 1901, Katerina Silka and Ellen Stone were traveling home after a teachers' convention when their party was suddenly surrounded by Bulgarian guerrillas, who abducted the two women and then disappeared into the Macedonian wilderness. The leader of this guerrilla band was Jan Sandanski. After this kidnapping, Sandanski sent a message to an American diplomat stationed in Istanbul that the kidnappers were demanding a ransom of over $100,000. This sum was equivalent to around $3 to $4 million today in 2025. So yeah, this is a hunk of change. Interestingly, Sandanski and his guerrillas initially tried to obscure their identities as Macedo-Bulgarians, and in their original correspondence, they actually claimed that they were Turkish. The MRO did this because they hoped to accomplish two goals at once. If they managed to extract this ransom while also convincing the American and European public that the captors were Turkish, then they could flush the MRO with a huge sum of money and also garner public sympathy for the Macedonian cause by harming the image of Ottoman Turks in the US and in Europe. Now, Sandanski had originally thought that this escapade would be over within a couple of weeks. But the Ms. Stone affair would end up sparking a little diplomatic crisis, and the negotiations would drag on for months and months. During this time, Sandanski and his guerrillas would form a very funny relationship with Ms. Stone and Katharina Szilka, as the missionaries would spend most of their time essentially trying to convert the Orthodox guerrillas to Protestant Christianity. Sandanski also eventually learned that Szilka was in fact pregnant, and she would give birth while living with Sandanski in the Macedonian wilderness. So this guerrilla band, who led a very rough lifestyle in which they went for days without eating and would like sleep in the snow, was now tasked with caring for an infant. Which, you know, as a recent father myself, caring for a newborn in the wilderness while also trying to evade the Ottoman authorities sounds quite challenging. Once Ottoman soldiers began tailing the guerrillas, their true identity as Macedonian revolutionaries was eventually revealed. And at that point, the U.S. government began negotiating directly with the MRO, instead of working through Ottoman diplomats, because, as you might expect, the Ottoman authorities desperately hoped to prevent the U.S. from paying this ransom, as it would give a very significant boost to a radical revolutionary party trying to topple their regime in Macedonia. And well, due to these tricky diplomatic considerations, it was eventually decided to raise the sum of money through public donations. And because this story had turned into a national sensation in the U.S., the Board of Foreign Missionaries successfully raised over $70,000, about $2.5 million today, from public donations alone. And so finally, after 5 months of negotiations, this very large sum was offered to the MRO, specifically going against the wishes of the Ottoman government. And when this offer was presented, Jan Sandanski quickly jumped at the opportunity, as he was pretty tired of deflecting the missionaries' attempts to convert him and to caring for an infant in the Macedonian wilderness. So, Ellen Stone and Katharina Szilka, along with Silka's newborn, were released completely unharmed. Now, along with going down as America's very first hostage crisis, the Miss Stone affair would have a complex legacy when it came to the Macedonian liberation struggle. Because, on the one hand, public attention in the Americas and in Europe had indeed been briefly fixated on Macedonia, but not necessarily in a way that was beneficial for Macedonian revolutionaries. Because after the true identity of Sandanski and his band was revealed, people began to see Slavic revolutionaries in Macedonia less as noble freedom fighters and more as terrorists. But at the same time, Ellen Stone herself would interestingly become a fierce advocate for the Macedonian cause. And while you might be able to chalk this all up to Stockholm Syndrome, Ms. Stone's championing of Macedonian liberation also likely stemmed from the fact that Jan Sandanski and his band really did treat their prisoners pretty well during their 5 months of captivity. And Ms. Stone was likely inspired by the determined resolve of Sandanski to fight for his people's liberation. So, the ultimate legacy of the Miss Stone affair is quite mixed, and you can see it from a lot of different angles. But what there is no arguing about is that the MRO just suddenly got more money than they had ever gotten at one single time. I mean, they now had $2.5 million in today's money, and for a bunch of unemployed teachers turned revolutionaries, this was an unimaginable sum of money. And having been the one to secure this payout, Jan Sandanski's standing within the MRO would continue to rise. In the next couple of years, the MRO would use this money to greatly expand their network of committees throughout Macedonia and Thrace. And they would also begin to purchase and construct more and more guns, ammunition, and bombs. And as we will see, the activities of the MRO, the supremacists, and other splinter groups would reach a fever pitch in 1902 and 1903. And so, next week, we will see a dramatic bombing campaign unleashed by Macedonian anarchists in Salonika. And we will also get to see the ultimate result of Goca Delchev's tireless network building, as a mass uprising will indeed break out in Macedonia and Thrace. The final act of this year of revolution would see over 20,000 MRO agents and Macedonian peasants following their lead rise up en masse in an attempt to drive the Ottomans out of Macedonia once and for all. This uprising would represent the pinnacle of Goca Delchev's vision for creating a multi-ethnic and multi-religious socialist federation in the Balkans, as during the uprising, the MRO would establish two short-lived republics in Macedonia and in Thrace. And for one of these republics, the MRO would make one of the very first attempts in history at establishing a peasant-led anarchist commune. And then, of course, we will also see yet another botched intervention from the great powers that will further radicalize officers in the Ottoman Third Army of Macedonia. So, join me next week as the MRO decides in 1903 that they need to take their shot, and they will launch the largest revolt in Macedonian history, the Ilinden Uprising.